So it's a new year. Don't know if you made any New Year's resolutions. Anyone resolved to get fit this year? Anyone resolved to go to the gym? Anyone resolved actually to use the membership card that they bought last year, but they've actually never used it? If you've ever been to a gym, when you go to a gym for the first time, it's actually quite intimidating. There's often lots of posters around. I don't know if you've seen a poster a little bit like this. Life's a journey, not a destination. Do you know that slogan is really helpful? I wholeheartedly agree with it. Life is not a destination, but life for sure has a destination. Remember the words of Jesus in Matthew 7:13-15. He says, "Enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow is the road that leads to life, and only a few find it." So according to Jesus, in those few verses, what's life all about? Life is about direction. Just two roads in life and two destinations after death. The most relevant question, therefore, you could be asking yourself this morning is this: where am I going? The most relevant question you could ask anybody else this morning is, where are you going? Life is not the destination, but life can rightly and helpfully be thought of as a journey. And that's very much what we're going to be doing in this new series, as we head into this new series in Exodus. We're going to be thinking of life as a journey. We've called it Life on the Road. We're going to be taking a journey with God's people. We're going to be tagging along with the children of Israel. We're going to be following closely a people who were for sure going somewhere. And here's one of the things we're going to note along the way. We're going to see that their journey in many ways mirrors our own journey. Their journey then in many ways mirrors our journey now. Anybody watch the DreamWorks animated version of the story of the Prince of Egypt? Anybody seen that one? Heard a recording of a guy speaking a Word Alive. His name's Richard Pratt, and he makes fun of his own name when he's in this country. But he was actually an advisor to the animators, to the director of that movie. And he was saying he was called in to give them some help with the storyline. And he asked the directors, the DreamWorks directors, "What's Exodus all about? Tell me, as you read this story, what's it all about?" And they said, "It's about freedom. It's about freedom from oppression." "Yes, it is," says Richard, "but anything else? Do you see something more?" And he persuaded them, he helped them to see that the Exodus was not just a journey from, it was a journey to. It's a journey from slavery, but these people were going somewhere. Coming out the other side of the sea wasn't the end of the story. It's not just what they'd left behind, it was also what was in front of them. It was not just what they were freed from, it was what they were freed to and freed for that was important. The last 8 seconds of that movie can be attributed to Richard Pratt. He got them to, he said, "Well, if you're not going to change the story as you've portrayed it, would you at least show them heading off towards Mount Sinai? Would you at least show the first step of that journey?" We're going to be making a number of journeys as we work through Exodus over these coming weeks. So in the context of that big journey that the Israelites were making from Egypt to the Promised Land, in the context of the journey they were making from oppression to rest, we're going to be looking at a number of smaller journeys along the way. I just want to show you the titles, actually, the headings to the nine sermons that we're going to be looking at between now and Easter. I think they will help you see what I mean by we're going to be making some smaller journeys along the way. So today, as we open up chapter 1, this is the journey we're going to be making, the journey from a family to a nation. We can see that happening. And then as we work through, we'll kind of capture another stage, another step of the journey underneath the umbrella of that big journey that they were making. So that's the plan. I want you to remember as we begin this morning, though, that the word Exodus simply means departure. It simply means exit or the way out. And I want you to note also, you may well have picked this up as we read through chapter 1 together. The two main themes that aren't to be missed in chapter 1 are the themes of blessing and oppression. Blessing and oppression. So with that in mind, this is how we're going to look at the passage this morning. We're going to firstly look at God's people blessed. God's people blessed. That's verses 1 to 7. Kids on a long journey can be really annoying, can't they? That famous little phrase, are we there yet? You've heard it said. I'm sure you said it as well when you were a kid. Are we there yet? Well, as the page turns from Genesis to Exodus, God is kind of saying to us, in answer to that question, nope, we're not there yet. The first word in the Hebrew scriptures in Exodus is the word and. And says so much, doesn't it? And says Exodus is the start of a new book, but it's not the start of a new story. And picks up the storyline that's already been laid down in Genesis. It picks it up and carries it on. It runs with the threads that have already been sown, if you like, in the book of beginnings. In many ways, the book of Exodus had to start with the word and. It had to start in that way. Why do I say that? I say that because there's so much by way of unfinished business. There's so much by way of unfulfilled promise in the book of Exodus. It had to be a continuation. It had to start with the word and. Are we there yet? No. This is just the next chapter in God's unfolding story of salvation. I don't know if anybody's seen the film The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. Anyone seen that one? The hotel owner has this saying, everything will be all right in the end, and if it's not all right, it's not the end. If you've heard that. For God's people, that's perfectly true. It's perfectly true. Everything will be all right in the end, globally and personally. Was everything all right at the beginning of Exodus? Is everything all right now? No. And the reason for that, it's not the end. Are we there yet? No, we're not. We're still traveling. The Christian life is very much a life lived on the road. We're not aimlessly gadding around. We're a people with a purpose. We're a people with a definite direction. Peter in the New Testament refers to sojourners, temporary residents. Or as the old chorus puts it, this world is not my home, I'm just passing through. That little word and tells us a lot as we begin this series. But here's the big one. Here's the big thing that and tells us. And tells us that God is totally committed to the blessing of his people. And tells us that God is totally committed to the blessing of his people. Let me just show you this verse. Do you remember this verse from Genesis 1, 28? And God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Look at verse 7 of Exodus 1. What do you notice in that verse? But the people of Israel were fruitful. They increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, and the land was filled with them. There's a thread running from Genesis 1:28 to Exodus 1:7. This is a sign of God's blessing on them. They were fruitful, they were multiplying, and they were filling the earth. Exodus is very much a new book, but it's not at all a new story. So we see here in verse 7, God's creation blessings, but you know there's more blessings on show here. Did you notice any of them? We can also see on show here some of God's promised blessings unfolding. So just look at the names in those first few verses. Where did Jacob, where did the Israel of verse 1 descend from? Well, Isaac was his dad. Abraham was his granddad. The family numbering 70 people in verse 5 had descended from the one man, Abraham. That's really important to know because God made that one man some very specific promises. And one of the things he promised to do was to bless him. Blessing is very much part of the promises that God made to this man and to his family. That he would bless him, bless his descendants, and actually through one of his descendants, bless all the nations of the world. God is committed to blessing his people. God is committed to blessing the world. That's what "and" tells us at the beginning of this book. The story's not finished yet. There's more blessings to come. Just flick back in your Bibles, if you've got them open, to Genesis 46. Genesis 46 and just the first a few verses there. So verse 2, God is speaking to Israel in a vision in the night. And says, "Jacob, Jacob." And he said, "Here I am." Then he said, "I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for there I will make you into a great nation. I myself will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also bring you up again. And Joseph's hand shall close your eyes. Don't be afraid to go to the land of Egypt, and I will make you into a great nation there." So in that promise in Genesis 12, 1 to 3, we can see the word land, we can see the word nation. These are very much on God's mind. These are very much part and parcel of God's blessing. God was blessing them. He made making them into a nation. And he would take them from the land of Egypt to the land of promise. So from Genesis 12 to Exodus 1, what we can do, we can trace the journey of God's people from one man to one family, from 1 to 70. But then, now we land in Exodus 1, we can trace another journey. So whilst there, God takes this family of 70 people on a journey from a family to a nation large enough for Pharaoh to be living in fear of them. That's the extent of God's blessing on this family. God is quite obviously blessing them. In verse 6, we see that Joseph dies, his brothers die, all of that generation is dead. But what's really evident here as we read on is that the promises of God are very much alive. The promises of God are very much alive. Let me just make a little application. Friends, don't ever doubt this. God was, we can see it here, God was and God is still heaven bent on blessing his people. If that's ever in doubt for you, if you have maybe through your circumstances have cause to question that, this story of Exodus should be really helpful to you, really helpful for you, and not least because it prefigures another story. It prefigures, it shadows, it mirrors the story of the cross where the descendant of Abraham who was spoken of in Genesis 12, the one through whom all the nations of the earth would be blessed, would hang on a Roman cross and pay the ultimate cost for these blessings that God has in mind for his people to enjoy. You ever doubt God's commitment to his blessing, spend some time in Exodus. Spend some time at the cross. So we can see in those first few verses, God's people blessed. I want us to see next, God's people oppressed. Verses 8 to 22. So verse 8, you'll see, brings about a change. There's a change of king, and that change of king brings about a change of circumstances for God's people. The blessing of God on his people, it is so much, it is so great, it is so extensive and expansive that it's not only noticed by the Egyptians, it becomes a fearful thing for the Egyptians. So what we're seeing here in these few verses now, we're seeing a change of attitude in the Pharaoh, change of attitude in the nation towards God's immigrant people. It's a change of attitude that actually we see leads to a change of immigration policy. No longer were these people to be considered as guests, but only as a threat to national security. I want you to notice, we'll see a two-part strategy on the part of Pharaoh to oppress God's people. He's going to try and counter God's blessing through oppression. That's what he's going to try and do. Okay. And the first way in which he oppresses God's people is through the oppression of slavery. It's verses 8 through to 14. So 400 years had passed since Joseph, Jacob's son, had saved Egypt in that wonderful way, saved the surrounding nations from famine. Time had gone by, that generation who knew Joseph personally, they were gone. And this blessed people of God were now becoming the oppressed people of God. Pharaoh, feeling the threat, set these taskmasters over the Israelites. They were forced to hard labor. They were working on one of Pharaoh's building projects. Just as you picture that scene, let me just ask some questions. I think they'll be helpful. Who wrote Exodus? Moses wrote Exodus. When did he write Exodus? Well, he wrote it on the road. He wrote it on the road somewhere between Egypt and the edge of the promised land. So he wrote it before he died. Why did he write Exodus? Why did he write Exodus? Surely he wrote Exodus so that the next generation of God's people would believe the promises of God and would trust the one who made those promises. So believe the promises and trust the promise maker. Surely he wrote these words to induce faith from them. Here is a God who can be trusted. They were to trust God even when all things, even when all people, even when all circumstances were seemingly against them. So how does Moses here in this first chapter win the trust of that future generation? What does he do to induce faith from them? Take a look. Mockery. He mocks Pharaoh. He mocks the most powerful man on that planet at that time. You can see that in verses 10 to 12. Pharaoh is fighting against God's commitment to bless his people. That's what he's fighting against. He's set himself up against God. That's what he's doing. He's fighting him. He's setting himself up against God, and he's fighting against God's commitment to fulfill those promises that he made to Abraham. And Moses is saying that's a futile fight. That's a fight no man can win. That's a fight no country can win. That's futile even for the most powerful men in the world. Verse 10, Pharaoh says, let's make them slaves in case they multiply even more. Verse 12, But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied. This is incredible. This is amazing. Slavery was Pharaoh's countermeasure to growth. But Moses is saying the more he oppressed us, the more we grew. What's the best form of contraceptive? It's no sex. Okay, that is the best form of contraceptive. Pharaoh's no fool. Can you see his logic? Okay. Work the men to the point of exhaustion. Treat them as slaves. Treat them harshly. Wear them out. Work them in long, hard days' labor. There won't be any energy for making babies when they get home. Moses is laughing at Pharaoh here. The harder you try, the more you oppress, the more God blesses his people. You don't know really who you're up against, Pharaoh, do you? Slavery proved to be good for the sex life of the Israelites. The oppression didn't hinder God's determination to bless his people. And he blessed them all the more. He blessed the men with virility. He blessed the women with fertility. What message was Moses sending through this mockery, to the future generations of God's people, including ourselves? What message was he sending to them and to us? Here's the first. So whatever the superpower, whoever the president, whoever the prime minister, whoever the pharaoh, no one, absolutely no one, can thwart the plans, the purposes, or promises of God. And that's true. However contrary things may seem or feel at ground level. For sure, God's people were being oppressed, but for sure, they were still being blessed. God was still at work, even in these most awful circumstances. God is still committed to blessing his people. Here's the second thing Moses would have that next generation here, would have us here. Don't factor God out of your circumstances. Don't factor God out of your suffering. Verse 8, we noted this change of king and that change of circumstances, but God does not change. He has committed himself to fulfill those promises. He has committed himself to bless his people. Though all things change, God will not change. He and those promises are unchanging. As William Cooper put it in his hymn, God may move in mysterious ways, his wonders to perform. And then he goes on to say, you fearful saints, fresh courage take. The clouds you so much dread are big with mercy and shall break in blessings on your head. Even through slavery, even through oppression, God is big enough, sovereign enough, good enough, faithful enough to work them through for blessing his people. Moses is saying, believe it. Don't doubt it. Live it. I want to make one more point of application here. It's a slight tangent, but I want to make it anyway. I fear, and I include myself in this, I fear that we as God's people have become blasé and desensitized to one of the most inhumane and most ungodly things that is happening on our planet and in our region right now. We've become desensitized and blasé about it. And that's modern day slavery. The statistics are absolutely shocking. 42 million people in our world today live in slavery, are denied their freedom in one way or another. I don't think that troubles us nearly enough. I'm hoping in the next few weeks to share with you some of the ways in which we can as a church become aware and be responsive to some of those needs that do exist in our world today. I really hope we can raise awareness and solicit support for the millions of people in our world who are caught up in slavery. Remember Micah 6:8? He has shown you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you, of us, God's people, to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God? Note Pharaoh's response to that continued blessing of God, verses 13 to 14. He works them even harder. He fights harder. But not even the intensifying of his strategy stopped God's blessing at all. So in Pharaoh's mind, something more drastic was needed, and that something more drastic was seen in the remaining verses 15 to 22. It was seen in the oppression of slaughter. Slavery was not reducing the numbers in any way that Pharaoh had hoped. In fact, the numbers were going the other way. Here's Pharaoh's plan B, slaughter. Let's get the midwives to kill every newborn baby boy. So his contraceptive plan had failed. He now turns to post-birth abortion. This was not a good time to be born a boy. The story now centers on these two heroic midwives. Interestingly, they get named. Pharaoh doesn't get named. I think a point's being made there. God is not impressed by your royal bloodline, your positions of standing, your job title. He is, however, much impressed by your actions. He's impressed by these two heroic, faith-filled women. They feared God, and they chose to make a difference where they were. They chose to make a difference in their everyday occupation, even if that meant defying the most powerful man in the world. So he commands them what to do, but they defy his command, and then he calls them back for some kind of disciplinary hearing, verse 18. But the midwives say that the Israelite women are tougher than the Egyptian women. And I think it's at that point that Pharaoh realizes he's on a bit of a loser here. And in this desperate escalation of his wickedness, do you see what he did next? He empowers the citizens of Egypt to kill the baby boys themselves by throwing them into the Nile. Verse 22, he commanded the citizens of his country to take things into their own hands, to take the baby boys and throw them into the Nile. This was licensed infanticide. This is the intentional killing of infants. This is state-sanctioned murder. It was heartless, it was barbaric, it was cruel, it was ruthless. It was preying on the innocent. It was picking on the defenseless. If you're thinking, how could he? How could he? Let me pose a question. Are things any different now? Are things any different now? What was the biggest killer of human beings in the year that's just passed? What was the biggest killer of human beings? 1.7 million people died from AIDS. 5 million people died from smoking-related diseases. 8.2 million people died from cancer. 42 million worldwide abortions were carried out in 2018. It's interesting, that's exactly the same number. 42 million. 42 million people enslaved in the world. 42 million abortions carried out last year. Just because Pharaoh made it legal, it didn't make it right. Here's the sobering reality for us this morning. We live in a country that not only legalizes the killing of babies, but it justifies it by arguing human rights. And it sanitizes it by calling it a medical procedure, like having your tooth out. And it vilifies anybody who opposes it. Bigots, out of touch with the modern world. I think it was President Reagan who said this. I'm not entirely sure on that. Possibly. He said, every person that argues for abortion has one thing in common. They've all been born. They've all been born. Very profound. So can I make the point that I made earlier in regards to desensitization? We as God's people need to wake up and rise up against this. I would love, in Grace Church here in Southport, I would love us to have a champion, someone who champions the cause of those who are enslaved. I would love us to have a champion to be a voice for the voiceless children of the world. I would love to have somebody, and could that be you, who would not let us forget, who would not let us become complacent about these big issues, that would keep shouting about it and keep reminding us of how we can do our bit, whether prayerfully or through action. If that's you, please come and see me. Please. And I realize, as I make that impassioned plea, I realize that this whole issue of abortion is complex and it's sensitive, and that occasionally there are good medical reasons for abortions to take place. But I'm talking abortion in relation to pro-choice. I'm talking about abortion in relation to lifestyle and convenience. And I realize as I say that this might be very personal for someone or someone's here. And if that's true, if that's so, can I assure you of three things? This is you. Can I assure you of three things? Here's the first thing I'd like to assure you of. What you did was wrong. It was sinful. It was wicked. It grieved the heart of God. I cannot play down the gravity of that decision. Here's the second thing I'd like to assure you of. God offers you complete and full forgiveness for what you have done. Even for something so horrific, even for something so awful and wicked, God will cleanse you from your every sin through faith in Jesus Christ. Every sin, every spot, every stain, even that one, wiped away. In such a way that this won't negatively impact your relationship with God. It will enhance your relationship with God. As you receive His forgiveness, as you live in the light of that washing, that cleansing, that new start He gives you, can I assure you that God will forgive you of that sin. He will not hold that against you if you come in faith. Ask and you'll receive. And here's the third and final thing I'd just like to assure you of, if that's you. Assure you of the wrongness of what you did. Assure you of the forgiveness you can receive. Here's the third thing I'd like to assure you of. So not only your forgiveness, but also the eternal well-being of the child that was aborted. That child, your child, is safe. I really don't believe that's my opinion. I believe from God's word that He, in His saving grace, has made provision for every aborted child, every young life cut short before or after birth. I believe God, in His grace, has made provision, has provided a place for them. Time doesn't allow me to develop that at all, but I'd be really happy to sit down with you in an open Bible to show you why I believe that's true, why I believe you can believe it's true too. Maybe if the Lord wills, I'll preach on it sometime. Life on the road for God's people can be hard, but be encouraged that we're not aimlessly drifting through life. We are going somewhere. No tyrant, no oppressive regime, no painful circumstance, no loss, no sin we commit can ever dampen God's commitment to bless His people or keep His promises. Will you take that into 2019 with you? That's what Exodus 1 wants us to take with us. Whatever you see when you look around you, whatever you see when you look inside you, would you remember this? God's not finished with the world yet, and God's not finished with you yet. There's an and in this story, and there's an and in your life. If you're one of God's people, the saying is perfectly true. Everything will be all right in the end. And if it's not all right, it's not yet the end.